Welcome to Exploring the Potential Role of PROTAC ER Degraders in the Management of Hormone Receptor Positive Metastatic Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Erica Hamilton from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. To begin, I asked her to provide a general overview of the types of endocrine-targeted treatments available and their mechanisms of action.
I think endocrine therapies have become the word salad of oncology now. So I'll give you some analogies that I tend to give my patients. And I think it's an easy way to explain to people that, you know, where they can understand. So tamoxifen is our oldest SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And what that means is that it can be agonistic in some tissues and antagonistic in others. So this is the reason we see a blood clot risk, an endometrial clot risk with tamoxifen, is it's agonistic to estrogen in those tissues. Antagonistic into breast. And how I explain it to my patients is it's like horses at the parade. They're wearing their leather blinders. So they're marching along. The crowd is still there, but they have their blinders on and they can't see it. And so that's what tamoxifen does, is it blocks the breast tissue from being able to see the estrogens there. It's also a little bit more of a natural endocrine therapy because it's not actually changing your baseline estrogen level. It's just preventing the breast or breast cancer cells from seeing that estrogen. Then we flip to SERD. So SERD, selective estrogen receptor degrader. This can be fulvestrant, it's intramuscularly. It can be newer oral drugs, for example, elacestrant. And this is actually degrading the estrogen receptor. So the molecule is going in, it's binding to the estrogen receptor, so it needs to have that binding site, and then flagging that as a foreign invader and, you know, trying to kind of, you know, chomp this up and spit it out. So in the presence of an ESR1 mutation where that estrogen signaling is flipped on, it's signaling through estrogen really, even if estrogen's not around, that's where the degrader comes in. You want something that can bind and actually get rid of that estrogen receptor because blocking estrogen isn't enough anymore. And then PROTAC is more similar to the SERD in terms that it's a degrader, but it's degrading in a unique way where there's a little molecule that, you know, our drug that can bind both the estrogen receptor, but also binds E3 ligase. And when they bind, it brings these two into close proximity where E3 ligase can ubiquitate the estrogen receptor, flag it as a foreign invader, and then the proteasome or our intracellular garbage can, trash compactor comes in, chews it up, and spits it out. That molecule is now free to go work on another estrogen receptor. So all working to prevent signaling from estrogen, but in different ways.
So yeah, I see the term heterobifunctional molecule applied to PROTACs, but it kind of sounds a lot like a bispecific in a way.
Yes. So this hetero bifunctional, you know, this is really where it can go, where we're adding additional things, just like when we talk about antibodies. Okay, well, what about if we have, you know, two different heads to that and it's both HER2 and EGFR? But, you know, I think that some of the applications for PROTACs is that you could have another target protein on there. You could have, you know, an immune molecule. You could have this photo switch. So I think it's just a different way, almost like Legos, where you could build a molecule targeting what you want to build.
It kind of sounds like what it is. So from your point of view, then, in terms of the final, you know, mechanism involved, do you consider fulvestrant, SERDs, and PROTACs all essentially functioning by getting rid in some way of the ER?
I think that they all get rid of ER in some ways, and I would group fulvestrant and oral SERDs in the SERD category, but I still keep PROTACs different in my mind, and I keep them different in my mind because, you know, in the small experience I had of enrolling patients to vepdegestrant that had already seen an oral SERD in phase one, I saw several responses that were actually in excess of oral SERDs. And so I do think this mechanism of the binding site not mattering as much because you're actually physically bringing that E3 ligase in, I get the gestalt that in some mechanisms of resistance, PROTAC may be superior.
So, you know, I heard something recently that I had not heard before, which I'm going to ask you if this is correct. It sort of makes sense. I never really thought about it, that people who are receiving fulvestrant and SERDs, the actual measurable ER, and when you do an ER assay, decreases. Is that true?
Yes, it certainly can. So if a patient is on something like fulvestrant and you're kind of down-regulating that estrogen off the cell surface, then if you go and test estrogen, you may find, oh, you know, it's low, but it's a function of the fact that they're on that treatment.
Same thing with PROTAC?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a lot of, you know, correlative data out of those studies yet, but I would imagine that, yes, it works in the same way.
And the other thing I thought about from a practical perspective would be perhaps this happening and somebody having a repeat biopsy and then the patient's considered triple negative and treated that way. When does the ER come back once they stop the SERD?
Yeah, it typically does. You know, I think that you bring up a good point, though, because in breast cancer, you know, we're a little bit more dependent on tissue, not just blood-based profiling, because we still care about these markers, ER, PR. We still care about HER2. You know, cancer can change its stripes in about 20% of patients. I've certainly had some patients that have had the emergence of a HER2 clone. So yes, I mean, I think it does come back. It also can still be there. Most of my patients, when I re-biopsy, I still do see some estrogen positivity. It's just lower than it was before.
So another kind of question I have is a lot of times you hear people talking about like the SERD data and say, well, there was a benefit with ESR1 mutant, but there was no benefit with ESR wild type. But could you also look at it, even though maybe it's not big enough to be an equivalency trial, to say, well, it's not that it wasn't inactive. It was just appears to be equally active to, for example, fulvestrant. Also leading to the question of actually, is there any there's adjuvant trials now where people are going to get a SERD without anything else. So I assume that it's thought to have, you know, basic activity, even though not as great with ESR1 mutant. Am I getting that right?
100%. I actually think that this is a really important comment. So, you know, it's not that patients that don't have an ESR1 mutation don't benefit from a SERD or a PROTAC, right? It just looks like it's equal or not significantly better than, you know, some of the older drugs. In fact, you know, in the phase one, I actually had some very long responders. Actually, all of my patients that were on this for over 2 years, oral SERD or a PROTAC, were actually wild type. So it's not that no patient, you know, could get significant benefit. I think it's just more a function of endocrine sensitivity. We know in a post-CDK4/6 landscape that endocrine resistance is just a big problem, and we don't have a great way to test for it. They're still ER positive on tissue. They might have done very well on their CDK 2, 3, 4 years. And so if we enrich for patients that have ESR1, we're more likely to get a more uniform population that still is signaling through the estrogen axis. But I think you're completely right. You know, as compared to a drug like fulvestrant that's intramuscular, you know, there are some advantages of these oral drugs as pills patients can take at home. It's probably not going to justify approval of something that's going to be costly compared to something that's now generic and cheap. But I don't think that it means it doesn't have activity. In fact, I know it has activity, and I feel very comfortable using these drugs in patients in the earlier line settings.
So another sort of side issue is it seems like a lot of these trials, they report the efficacy in the ESR1 mutant, but then the other thing they report, as you just described with vepdegestrant, is you report intention to treat with all patients. And why don't you report ESR1 wild type and ESR1 mutant? Is that some kind of statistical thing, or why do you do that?
Yeah, it's how they designed the statistics. So the primary endpoint was PFS among ESR1. And then if that's positive, you test all comers. And so then the all comers were negative, so you stopped. So they're not going to then go, and we know that the wild type didn't get benefit. So yeah, it's kind of how they allocate their alpha from a statistical standpoint.
So another thing that you discussed that I thought was really interesting, but also pretty complicated, was mechanisms of resistance to endocrine therapy. You went through all kinds of genetic, you know, factors. And one of the ones that stuck out to me was AKT. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more and whether there's any thought about combining AKT inhibitors with PROTACs or SERDs.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we currently have an FDA-approved AKT inhibitor, capivasertib. It's approved in combination with fulvestrant in that second-line setting. And again, as opposed to PI3, that's just for PI3 alteration, capivasertib is approved for AKT, PI3, and P10. So we boost up that, you know, percentage of patients that will have one of those alterations a little bit by including those other two. So, you know, I think that it is a mechanism of resistance. I don't think it's universal. I think when we first started looking at CDK4/6 resistance, we thought, oh, it's probably going to be an RB story. And then, you know, lo and behold, when we did biopsies, we saw, you know, some patients have RB, but that's certainly not the answer of CDK4/6 resistance. It's pretty multifactorial. I think that's the same here. You know, we've got MAP kinase, you know, pathways. We have other mutations. We have loss of ER. You know, it's not that patients aren't ER positive anymore. It's just that it's not the driving pathway in the cell. And that's actually tough for us to pick out on a profiling report that may show multiple mutations of what's the driver versus what's the passenger, for an analogy.
So another issue as it relates to mechanisms will really relate to ESR1 that I keep hearing, but I don't exactly understand, is that you see ESR, people always start out saying you see ESR1 mutations in the situation of endocrine resistance, mm-hmm. Yet I believe that I think it's true that you don't really see it in people who become resistant to adjuvant AIs. Is that correct?
Yes. So it's present in historical data sets of about 5% in the first line setting. Now, my guess is that that's going to go up a little bit as we're using AI with CDK4/6s in the adjuvant setting for patients that are higher risk. But I agree with you. The terminology is a little bit tricky because on one hand, we're saying ESR1 endocrine resistance. But on the other hand, we're saying if you have one, it predicts benefit to these drugs where you need an ESR1 mutation. So what is it? So we're saying that it's endocrine resistance because these patients have already progressed on something like AI, but the mutation does predict dependence on that estrogen pathway, where if we switch to something like PROTAC or SERD, they can still be sensitive. So it's true, they had resistance, but it's also predicting sensitivity to these newer compounds.
Is there anything specific about the resistance to CDK inhibition that leads to ESR1?
Not that we know of. There's nothing specific that really CDKs are leading to ESR1. I think the driver is that in the presence of CDK, you're going to be on your aromatase inhibitor longer. We know that, you know, from the first line trials, PFS about doubles 10 to about 20, 22 months. And so the longer you're on the AI, probably the likely, you know, higher likelihood that you end up with an ESR1 mutation in the cancer.
So another thing that's kind of interesting to me is a lot of these studies, and I think you said that with Veritech, it was close to 80% had prior fulvestrant, so which suggests that people who are resistant to fulvestrant might be sensitive to PROTACs, and I don't know, I guess, SERDs, and what the mechanism would be. Do any of these studies, I guess it's hard when you have 80%, but look at correlations between, you know, do you see better responses if they've never had fulvestrant? You know, in terms, and also, do you see better responses in people whose ER drops?
Yeah, in the phase one, we had 80% of patients that had seen prior fulvestrant. It was just a more heavily pretreated. And in fact, we saw a lot of responses there. So, you know, I think in general, the endocrine agents, you know, the earlier you are, the more sensitivity you have. As these patients get treated repeatedly, they become more endocrine resistant. And in fact, you know, that's how we treat somebody that, you know, truly has endocrine resistance, is we move on to chemotherapy, ADCs, like a triple negative. We know we can't target that estrogen any longer. But I definitely think that there's kind of tiers of endocrine therapy now. Just because somebody had, you know, fulvestrant and a CDK maybe in the first line, they did okay on it, they were on for 12 months, I would feel very comfortable moving to one of these novel agents because we have seen great data.
You know, of course, all the time in oncology, and SERDs is a great example, we're constantly having to compare things indirectly. And obviously now with vepdegestrant in front of the FDA, we could soon be looking at a situation where people are going to be choosing, for example, between a SERD, at this point, elacestrant, and a PROTAC vepdegestrant at this point. And obviously that's going to be a key clinical question. And I wonder if, you know, you went through all the data you presented at ASCO, but just taking a step back more globally, again, thinking about yourself on rounds, and first thinking about the efficacy of what you saw in that study, were there any findings or patients, you've already referred to a couple of patients you actually saw on the study, related to efficacy that provides any kind of clues? I'm not saying, obviously it's an indirect comparison of the efficacy of a PROTAC, for example, vepdegestrant versus a SERD, for example, elacestrant.
Yeah, I think it's really tough. It's tough to compare, you know, trials to trial. I think the advantage of both the VERITAC vepdegestrant study as well as Emerald elacestrant was that everyone had already seen CDK4/6s, so it was a very uniform 100% prior treated with CDK. And so it's a little bit easier to cross trial comparison those, actually. And you know, tiny bit bigger benefit with vepdegestrant compared to elacestrant. We also know biologically elacestrant is almost more like a SERM. It's the less SERD-y of the SERDs. So, you know, other drugs like imlunestrant, camizestrant, giredestrant, you know, some of those other oral SERDs are a little bit more SERD-like. And, you know, this shouldn't surprise us because it's hard to compare these trials across each other. But I really do get the idea that GI toxicity can be different between the oral SERDs. There are some that have a little bit more nausea and diarrhea, and then there are some that are a little bit cleaner and don't have that. And I kind of see efficacy little bit of differences there. You know, camizestrant also has some bradycardia and that kind of waffling at the edge of the vision when the light changes on and off. So we know that that's unique to camizestrant compared to the others, which again tells us it's a little bit different. So I suspect that we're going to get smarter in terms of individual, even ESR1 mutations or, you know, something in the tumors that can point us in one direction over the other. But I think the hardest question today is kind of single agent novel endocrine therapy versus combination. Because on one hand, we like the activity of combination, whether we're combining, you know, with a PI3, an AKT, a CDK, but it adds toxicity. And our patients are really wanting therapies that are very well tolerated. And I think that's something that, you know, a vepdegestrant, et cetera, really provides for us.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also in terms of comparative toxicity, which you sort of got into a little bit. I'm curious what you see in terms of toxicity with SERDs. You know, I hear about GI things. I had one person actually describe it more like a dyspepsia type syndrome rather than nausea. I don't know what you exactly see. So hard to be clear about that. What do you see? How much of a problem? It looks like, you know, dose reduction seems very, very uncommon regardless, whether it's a SERD or a PROTAC, but can you, you know, you obviously have a lot more experience with this agent, vepdegestrant, than anybody. Anything that you see or feel that, you know, you think maybe 2-3 years from now are going to flesh out in terms of difference in tolerability? Do you think people are going to end up preferring the PROTAC?
I think that the PROTAC is very clean in terms of GI toxicity. You know, that 2% reduction, 3% discontinuation. I mean, I think honestly, in a registrational trial, that's pretty astounding, to be quite honest. I think that there are some of the oral SERDs that are also much cleaner in terms of GI toxicity than some of the others. And it's very difficult. I don't want to come out and say I think this one's worse than this one. But having worked with a lot of them across the phase one, I do think that they have differential GI toxicity profiles. I find that some are much easier for my patients. And I do agree with that. It's not nausea. I mean, it's not ADC nausea. People aren't at home throwing up all the time. It's this stomach unsettled, you know, have to be careful about what I eat. And the problem is it's not really an issue with single agent very often, but it's when you want to add an additional medicine that also goes through the GI tract that then it really just kind of is synergistic in terms of that toxicity. And I think it makes patients struggle a little bit more in terms of combinations.
It kind of, you know, we'll talk in a minute about the survey we did of 20 breast cancer investigators recently, and also that we're going to do another one that I want to get your thoughts about what we should ask people. But it seemed, and I'll show you the data, it seems like at least at this point, based on what they saw, really, I guess when you presented it at ASCO, that it's pretty hard right now for a lot of investigators to distinguish the risk-benefit profile of, you know, for example, elacestrant and vepdegestrant. They kind of, I think, is that your take, that most of your colleagues at this point are kind of viewing it as a sort of a coin flip?
I think so. And to be quite honest, it's probably subtle. You know, I think in general, compared to other classes of drugs, et cetera, they're pretty well tolerated, and it's probably fair to somewhat put them in a bucket.
You know, the other thing is when you're focused more on PFS as opposed to response rate, sometimes it gets kind of interesting. When I think about, you know, you hear this figure of SERD monotherapy around 5 or 6 months PFS. It looks like kind of that's what you saw there with vepdegestrant. I mean, when you think about 5 months in, is that your second set of imaging by that point? Is that when you're, in general, when they're progressing? And do you feel like when you can't see a response, but do you think you can, you know, feel the benefit these patients are experiencing when they get monotherapy, understanding that maybe in the future there's not going to be that much monotherapy, but at least right now, do you think there's significant benefit?
I do. And I think it, I think the best way to describe it is think about what that 5 months means. You know, if you look at the Emerald curve or the vepdegestrant curve, you had about 30, you know, or 40% of patients that progressed on the first scan, right? So that's 2 months, right? So it's not that the patient that's going to get benefit is going to get 5 months benefit. My patients tend to get either more benefit than that, or they progress at their first scan. And so that's really the average of where it sits. But my patients that are benefiting, I mean, I've had multiple patients that are benefiting 9 months, 12 months, in excess of a year. So, you know, I think that's why, that's my argument against people that say, well, it's just 5 months. Like, should we even do this, or should we just move on to ADCs? Well, for that patient that potentially is going to delay needing to get a cytotoxic therapy by a year, that's meaningful for them. So we kind of owe it to give that a shot, if that makes sense.
No, for sure. And, you know, we actually, last week, we did a think tank for 3 hours just about SERDs. And, of course, one of the things we were talking about was SERENA-6. And I'm going to ask you about that as well, just because it's part of the whole scene. But one of the things that they brought up was this issue of quality of life, that they started to see some quality of life differences. I think there's some more quality of life data coming along. But when you stop and think about it, of course, there the PFS difference was greater. But still, as you say, when you're talking about, you know, basically a situation that's not curable, to delay the onset of progression, most likely symptoms from progression, it's almost obvious. If you want to choose, you want to progress at 3 months or 5 months or 9 months, it almost seems obvious your quality of life is going to be better if you're not progressing.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And it's very anxiety producing for patients, you know, to A, be told they have metastatic disease, and then that first progression event, you know, it's disappointing. It's scary, right?
Right. I mean, it's a different situation, too, where essentially almost everybody is going to progress. It sort of depends at what point. And so that really becomes I guess, the focal point for quality of life. I was just fascinated by all the other so-called PROTAC applications you have. It's interesting, too, you were mentioning PROTACs and other diseases. And, you know, as you were presenting the vepdegestrant, I was kind of flashing on pirtobrutinib versus the other BTK inhibitors. That, you know, like acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib are extremely well tolerated, but yet pirtobrutinib people believe is even a little bit, I'm not saying the mechanisms are the same, but it's that feeling that you can't, again, it's an indirect comparison. You know, people just go, wow, we never see any problems. And I wonder if that's the way it's going to flesh out here, that you have two very well tolerated therapies, but one maybe is going to be a little bit more tolerated. Anyhow, what can you just, again, you kind of went through this very fast. And I'm like, what is this? Talk again a little bit slower about what a CLIP-TAC is, a photoprotac, an antibody protac conjugate. I can't even tell whether we should be saying bispecifics or ADC, whether ADCs are sort of bispecifics. I don't know. But anyhow, can you take a shot at talking about these future strategies using PROTACs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all a little bit futuristic. So this is a little bit of what's coming in space slide. But, you know, I mean, I think that it's really exciting because you just see the way, kind of like when we were talking about antibody drug conjugates. Okay, you've got a payload, you've got an antibody, you can switch these out, you can come up with a bunch of different molecules, right? And that's kind of the way a PROTAC is. So, you know, you've got your target of interest, the protein on one side, and then you have kind of whatever, you know, is being put on the back end, right? This, you know, recruiter to E3 ligase and the example of that vepdegestrant. But the photoprotac, I think, is fascinating. So essentially a trifunctional molecule. So you have the E3 ligase, the degrader. You have the side that's binding the point of interest, but then you also have a photo switch. And so the ability to turn the molecule on or off in the presence of like blue violet light. So you can imagine maybe there's a target where you're going to get, you know, bad toxicity in the GI tract because it's expressed there, but you want to treat the lung. Well, you could do it based on like exposure to light or exposure to radiation. You know, could you have a mechanism where you could activate the drug in certain locations and not the other location? I think it's interesting. Wow. Certainly not ready for prime time. And then antibody PROTAC conjugate is essentially taking the PROTAC, but then also adding an antibody to where you're selectively delivering that drug to the cells that express that antigen that the antibody binds. So selectively delivering a PROTAC to HER2 positive cells, for example. Again, maybe, you know, in places where there's going to be toxicity, a way to really limit it where it goes and control the tolerability.
Yeah, I saw that term photo switch. I'm like, what is that? But that is really wild. You know, blue violet light. What a wild concept. All right, well, let's get back to where we are today. And I want to show you some of the things that we asked in this survey. But also, I wanted to ask you about this press release that just came out. I guess it was yesterday, I think. Yeah, right, yesterday. Another press release of a phase 3 trial, the EV-ERO study. I don't know if you're involved with that. This is giredestrant. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's interesting is it's combined with everolimus, and at least they refer to, I don't know if they say exactly whether it works in ESR1 wild type, but what do you know about this study? I mean, I don't know whether you're involved with it at all, but I'm sure you're aware at least of the design, and I don't know, are we going to see this at ESMO or San Antonio?
I don't know where we're going to see this. You know, we just saw a press release yesterday, so it may be a little bit late for ESMO, or we could see it in one of the late breaking sessions. But I'd anticipate that, yes, we're going to see this before the end of the year, whether it's at ESMO or San Antonio Breast. I think this is a really interesting study, and I struggle to make, you know, too big of conclusions because I think we're really going to need to see the data. But a couple of interesting points here. So one, they're saying the benefit is an intention to treat and ESR1 mutation. So elacestrant was that way, right? Our all-comer was positive there, but then when we actually dove into the data, it was kind of, you know, less than one scan interval if you were wild type. Really, you know, that 1 month difference that we were able to enrich to 2 months for ESR1. So I want to see what's the difference. You know, is it kind of barely positive in intention to treat, and it's really the ESR1 mutations that are driving it, or is it truly beneficial in both? And then the other interesting thing is this is our first randomized data with everolimus. So everolimus is interesting in breast cancer because the benefit there, although it's in PI3, mTOR, AKT axis, the benefit is among all comers. You don't have to have an alteration. So it's different than alpelisib. It's different than inavolisib. It's different than capivasertib. And so with that everolimus combo, it may be true that this is actually beneficial across ESR1 mutation or not. And then I'm also intrigued to see tolerability. Everolimus is one of those drugs that's consistently underestimated. We keep thinking about it as an old drug and, oh, we can do better than that. And, you know, it's a good drug. So it'll be very interesting to see the magnitude of benefit here for this data.
Incidentally, nowadays, how much of an issue is mucositis with everolimus?
It's not a huge issue. I think we have a little bit more mucositis with some of our ADCs, actually. The SWISH study of oral dexamethasone mouth rinse really cut down on the oral mucositis. The only patients that I have that get in trouble with it are the patients that do the oral dex rinses and say, oh, well, I'm not going to get that side effect, and they stop it, and then they get the mucositis. So you really have to educate your patients quite clearly. If you don't get it, don't stop it, because you don't want to get it or it's hard to get rid of.
Yeah, that was one of my most favored quotes from the program I did with you on Dato-DXD, and I always quote to other people. Of course, I hear it from a lot of people, the issue of preventive mouthwash. All right, let's talk a little bit about the survey we just did of 20 investigators. Again, we have quite a great group here, I think comparable to the kind of groups that NCCN gets. A lot of nationally recognized people are nice enough to participate. And very interesting, we also at the same time did the same survey plus some other questions for community-based oncologists. And I want to, this is actually, these are some of the summaries. Seth Wander and Maxwell Lloyd, I don't know if you know him, he's a fellow who's going to go on the faculty at MGH soon, working with us on this. And they looked at our data, and I'm going to show you the conclusions they came up with and talk a little bit about it. But one has to do with what you were talking about in your talk, which is the issue of looking for biomarkers and when to look for them. And they noted that when we asked the question, when you do it, that most people did it at progression, as you were saying, more likely to see ESR1 mutation status, but it's a fair number at metastatic diagnosis. And actually, I was thinking a lot more about this question. I realized, I think in this next survey, I want to ask the question differently. Because as you were saying, the reality is when you order assays, you're going to get ESR1 and AKT, PIK3. And nowadays, as you said, we need to, so if you order either one, you're going to get both, right?
Yes, absolutely, so, if you're ordering a broad panel, which most of us do.
So, and the reality is, at least in terms of looking for a possible inavolisib triplet, as you were saying earlier, you're going to want to look for PIK3 in patients who relapse on endocrine therapy within a year of endocrine therapy, not necessarily with de novo, although I've seen people say they want to use it in de novo. So it kind of seems like if we presented a de novo case and said, would you test, it might be interesting compared to a patient who relapsed on. That would maybe tease out this a little bit more. Any thoughts about that? I guess the typical first line case is a patient who's on endocrine therapy, I would think, which means
most of the time it is. And I think that's why you're seeing it split, is because a lot of times it's not actionable in that first line setting, right? We're going to be giving CDK4/6 in combination with endocrine therapy, but there are those circumstances where it could be.
And then another thing, again, just reinforcing what you were saying in terms of, I think most people have got the message that circulating DNA liquid biopsies is better or more sensitive, but there are people who do both. I mean, do you ever see disparities between where you see it positive or in the tissue but not in the circulating DNA?
I haven't seen that. I've seen the other way around, where I biopsy a lesion and it's negative and I see it in the blood, but not in that way.
So this is what we asked him about vepdegestrin. I know I sent these questions to you to get your answer. And You know, we asked them actually to talk, you know, to actually write some stuff in there in terms of what they're thinking about if this agent becomes available. And, you know, really most of them have not, I guess, participated in the study, so really don't have any experience with it. I think the bottom line was that, as we were saying before, I think the perception has been that they're similar and going to be hard for them, at least at this point, until we have more data to separate out which to prefer. It sounds like maybe you, if you had equal access, might prefer the vepdegestrant for the GI issue. But also it brings up the question, can you use one after the other? And a lot of people say they wouldn't do that. And if they do, they would use elacestrin first. How would you answer this? So I think you referred to some people who had elacestrin who actually responded to vepdegestrin. So
yeah,
is that something you think is worth doing?
They had a variety of oral SERDs because, you know, at the time it was all during clinical trial, so it wasn't, you know, a commercially marketed oral SERD. I think the reason you're seeing a little bit of hesitation is that we all have, you know, a little bit of angst just that patients aren't remaining endocrine sensitive as long as we would like them to in the post-CDK4/6 landscape. And so, you know, when you see a PFS of, you know, 5 months, et cetera, and then you say, okay, and if I do endocrine therapy again, how long is somebody going to get at it? And so I think people just start to feel it's more likely that we're going to have progression at that next scan. But there are some patients that, you know, do very well. You know, they're the 5 years on AI CDK4/6. They're the exceptional responder that does well for months and months on elacestrant. Absolutely, I would try something again because that's the patient that hasn't, you know, indicated to us that their biology is endocrine resistant, and why would we want to move them to chemo without trying it? I mean, I think as long as you have close scans and you're watching that patient carefully, that would be quite reasonable.
So again, I want to kind of paint a picture of where we are today, at least from what we saw with these investigators and where we are with you, and that helps us understand where vepdegestrin might fit in with an increasingly complicated story, so to speak. One of the other variables, and I'm not going to show you all the data, but you know, it's kind of all in this type of format where you can see what everybody does. But another variable we tested out that's been discussed a lot, in terms, particularly in terms of second line treatment, is the time on CDK. And we chose, because it sounds like people talk a lot about a year, although I don't know how precise that is, that if it's less than a year on CDK, they consider them relatively resistant, at least compared to somebody who might have been on it for a couple years. So we had two scenarios. One was a progression of 10 months, and the other was, I think, 2.5 years. And, of course, we saw a great difference there in terms of, first of all, in the double mutant, whether or not they would use elacestrant or AKT, specifically CAPI, but also whether or not to use hormonal therapy at all. Mm-hmm. You know, in HER2 low patient, considering TDXD, or more likely capecitabine or other chemotherapy as opposed to trying second line therapy. How do you approach the patient who doesn't, you know, is not on a CDK very long? How does that alter your approach? What does it get? And where does patient symptoms, visceral disease, it seemed like when we presented people with visceral disease and symptoms who relapse early, that really was a trigger to go to ADCs or capecitabine. How do you factor in, and what time period do you think about? You were talking about people who were on it for 3 or 4 years, but what about on the other end of the spectrum? What about like a year or less? How do you think that through?
Yeah, I find that those are the situations that tell me something. So the fact that somebody does well on CDK for a long time, okay, they could be endocrine sensitive, they could be endocrine resistant. They clearly were very sensitive to CDK. But if you're doing poorly on first line CDK, that's a bad prognostic indicator. That's telling me that the patient has endocrine resistance. So I agree. When we're getting towards, you know, small number of months on a CDK, I don't have much confidence that there's another endocrine therapy that's going to work. I don't think the 1 year is firmly, you know, drawn in the sand. If somebody's getting 10 months, et cetera, you know, am I just going to move right to chemo? Probably not, but I'm probably going to be thinking more about an endocrine combination, you know, if they have a mutation in AKT PI3 or using something kind of in combination with Abema, not relying on that single agent as much if they've got some factors that are making me worry a bit more.
And that kind of leads also to something I've been finding very interesting as we've been doing these surveys over the last few years, which is the doubly mutated patient, ESR1, and in this case, we're just going to say PIK3. And it is kind of interesting in terms of whether they go, for example, with capifulvestrant versus elacestrant in terms of approved. When we present a patient who relapsed early, 10 months, has symptomatic disease, people tend to go to CAPI. This is one interesting thing I was just kind of curious about, not so much about PROTAX, but about community practice. We saw, surprisingly, we didn't see any alpelisib use with the investigators, but with the 50 oncologists, we had about 10 of them, 20%, who said they use alpelisib, which kind of surprised me. When I've asked other investigators, they sort of nod their head that they see this sometimes. Are people still using alpelisib?
I don't use a lot of alpelisib. Again, I think that, you know, tolerability can be a struggle, especially in the South where I practice. You know, capivasertib is not a perfect drug. I mean, we still have quite a bit of diarrhea. We have rash. But we've been able to all but eliminate the hyperglycemia. So it's one less thing for the patient to get in trouble with and for me to worry about. And so I do tend to use Capiva in those circumstances where I used to use alpelisib.
So, and again, we've seen that universally with investigators. That's why I was surprised when I saw the community oncologist. So now we go to a situation where the patient has been on CDK with AI for 2.5 years and is minimally symptomatic with bone mets without visceral disease, again, doubly mutated. And you see people going with elacestrant. I assume because it's better tolerated. I mean, I think it's almost a given that it's much better tolerated than even CAPI. So in a situation where you don't feel, I guess, a pressure because of symptoms or visceral disease, that's where people tend to land. Is that where you're landing now? And do you see, what about the double mutated patient with vepdegestrant?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. This is kind of where I land, but I actually find it fascinating that there's so much concordance. You know, I think you've got two things going for you in this case, you know, clear benefit on CDK, 2.5 years, and then specifically calling out bone metastases. So I think, you know, people feel like, you know, if the patient was going to be somebody that progressed at 2 or 4 months, that there's less to lose in this scenario. You're not worried about getting in trouble with visceral crisis from a liver met, et cetera. And for sure, a single agent endocrine therapy, I think, is always going to be better tolerated than a combination. And this patient's 80 too, right?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. That was actually, it's more when they're 80, but even if you say 65, you still see elacestrant. We didn't even see that much difference with the 80-year-old and the 65-year-old as a, you know, I think people tend to treat 80-year-olds, unless they have serious comorbidities, kind of similar to younger. Is that kind of the way you think it through?
Yeah, once you're in the 80s, though, you know, the opportunity to do harm if somebody really ends up with, you know, horrible diarrhea and passes out or has a fall, you know, just things go poorly quicker in older patients. I just don't think they have quite the reserve sometimes with some of these side effects that can be problematic.
So again, I'm always trying to tease out things when we have to indirectly compare. I'm curious if you're going to start a patient, whether they're 80 or even younger, on a SERD like elacestrant versus a PROTAX as like vepdegestrant versus capifulvestrant. When you have these three situations, how would you rate the likelihood that you're going to encounter some type of toxicity that's going to be problematic, that you may have to hold the dose for, that may be an issue? My sense would be very, very low for the SERD and PROTAC and significantly higher, although I'm curious what number, how often you see a significant problem with CAPI. You know, we ask the docs in practice have used it so little, you know, a lot. Typical doc maybe has used it once, which, you know, we talk about all the time. So they don't really have a feel for it. What's your experience?
Yeah, I have used all of them quite a bit. I would say that I've never had a patient that's come off vepdegestrant for tolerability. Maybe I'm naive and really lucky, but I would put that very small single digits, less than 1%. Elacestrant, I would say very well tolerated, less than 5%. And the chance of having to dose reduce or, you know, discontinue Capiva, I would probably say maybe about a third of patients.
That's what I was about to say. 30% is kind of what I hear. So I want to run by two other things that I thought very interesting, just to get your take on, again, in terms of sort of the endocrine environment nowadays. The first thing, it relates to what you were just talking about, which is probably the future of these agents, which is combinations. And, you know, we asked people, particularly about the Ember-3 combination of imlunestrant and abemaciclib, and, you know, we asked their comments about first line, but obviously particularly second line. And there were a lot of people who were very open to that strategy, and actually quite a few people using the post-Monarch strategies just to start with. In a way, I kind of begin to look at this a little bit like a combination of post-Monarch and SERD. People bring up the fact there wasn't a control arm of just Abema, but it kind of, I'm getting the feeling that if this combination were available, that it would not be infrequently used. I'm curious what you're thinking. If this were to become available, would you use it, and in what situations?
Yeah, I think you're hearing the excitement now that you're not kind of having to pick the novel endocrine agent or the combination. You're getting both here, right? So it's not a fulvestrant with Capiva, a fulvestrant with, you know, alpelisib. You're getting imlunestrant, so an oral SERD, but then you're also doing a switch of your CDK. So I think that is compelling. I particularly would use it for patients that have kind of what I like to call bland mutation profiles, so don't have the PI3, AKT, maybe don't have the ESR1, because we know fulvestrant alone isn't good enough for our patients. And so I think, you know, a combination there would be really attractive.
Do you see the day coming in the near future where you're going to use vepdegestrant and a CDK?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're not going to be able to use that right now because the registrational trial we have is only vepdegestrant as a single agent. So that would require another trial for regulatory approval to be able to use that. Certainly in phase one, they have looked at multiple combinations, including multiple different CDK4/6 inhibitors. But I would be excited to use it in combination, yes.
Kind of makes sense. So the other thing I wanted to show you was something I thought was probably the most interesting thing, although it doesn't relate necessarily to PROTACs, but maybe it will in the future. And this is about SERENA-6. So I guess you could say early second-line therapy, or as Dr. DeMichel in the discussion referred to it as molecular progression, which I haven't heard that one before, but when you see ESR1, incidentally, do you believe that, would you call it molecular progression when you see ESR1 pop up in a patient on a CDK?
I don't think that's an unfair statement. I think I'd be more likely to call it emergence of a resistance mutation, but I think molecular progression is fair. I just hesitate to use the word progression because the control arm, when they stayed on their therapy, it actually took them 9 months to progress, which was actually a big takeaway from that study. I mean, that's actually more impressive than I thought it would be.
Yeah, no, I thought it was kind of an interesting term also, because technically, as you say, it's really the evolution of a resistance mutation. So anyhow, when Seth and Max saw our data on SERENA-6 and what people wanted to do about it, they wrote this to summarize it, to saying that people think that looking for ESR1 ahead of overt radiographic progression is not justified. So kind of echoing Dr. DeMichel's discussion of the data right after it was presented. But this is kind of where the way we do things in like the NCCN and other guidelines differs, because yeah, it's true that most people are not sort of ready for prime time. But what I thought was interesting was that 7 out of the 20 were. And there are some pretty prominent people in there who say they would like to do it. And I don't know, I'm sure you're networking with your colleagues all the time. Interestingly, the community-based oncologists is even more positive. 2/3 want to do it based on what they saw in the data. And then when we presented a scenario of a patient to the investigators who develops an ESR1 a year after starting a CDK, even though most of them said they wouldn't switch, a number of them would. And if we went out to 2 years, again, even more with the general oncologists, and then we go out to 2 years, even more would. So I would say, I don't know if this is what I would call a consensus. This is where our, you know, our sort of putting a little granularity into it. It kind of reminds me of the St. Galen approach where you can actually see the numbers. So I was actually surprised. I thought everybody, because the few people I talked to were all, you know, Dr. D. Michelle, like, let's hold off. And yet I was kind of surprised to see this. So I'm very curious what your thoughts are about this and what you're thinking.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough topic. I think first off, I mean, it was an exciting proof of concept, right? We can detect these mutations. If we switch, people do better. There were still some residual questions from SERENA-6 that I think are making people hesitate to widely adopt it. First off, I'll tell you that I don't find it surprising at all that the general oncologists are more likely to do it than the breast subspecialists, because they have better data in GI cancers, colon cancer, et cetera, where this really is prime time now. And so, you know, it's hard to separate out all the disease type of, well, what's the level of evidence in breast and what's the level of evidence in GI? And so I think the moral of the story is the level of evidence to do this in breast is not where it is in the GI literature. And so that's the reason that we're more hesitant to do it. In terms of getting into the SERENA-6, you know, it was a 7-month improvement in progression-free survival if you switched. The challenge was these patients didn't go on to get an oral SERD. In SERENA-1, if we compared camizestrant to, you know, fulvestrant, it was 7 versus 2 months. So it was a 5-month benefit if you got cami. And so that kind of makes me think, well, if we'd just given them cami when they progressed, they would have had an extra 5 months on PFS2. And then we're talking about doing all this and all the serial testing for 1 or 2 months. We don't have that data. Then on the other hand, you know, kind of compelling data was the quality of life data. But looking at that, I had a lot of questions because the quality of life separated at 4 weeks. It couldn't have been progression. These patients didn't progress until 9 months later. So are we supposed to believe that, you know, somehow there were bone mets that were causing more pain or more fatigue from visceral mets or something that hadn't actually happened or weren't detectable for another 8 months that separated this? And people may come back and say, well, Dr. Hamilton's crazy. But I think if I had to predict what that is, it's stopping the AI. It happened immediately at 4 weeks. I think patients felt better because they weren't having arthralgias and bone pain from AI. Wow. I think camizestrant was a better tolerated drug and it separated in a month. So that's my prediction. You know, somebody could make an idiot out of me later.
No, I mean, that's a really interesting thought. And also, when you think about the adjuvant trials of SERDs, are there adjuvant? Is there an adjuvant trial of PROTACs, incidentally? So, you know, there, it'll be interesting.
No. Oh, no. There's multiple trials of adjuvant SERDs, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, like, how tolerability compares to an AI also. That'll be very interesting. Right. AI is not always a walk in the park. I will point out that, you know, getting back to the general oncologist, that colon, you're talking about cure versus not cure. Whereas here, it's a question of how long they're going to be before, you know, the typical question that comes out in oncology. But another thing that I've been thinking about is, you know, it sounds like at this point you would not want to do this kind of strategy because maybe in the long run it wouldn't really be beneficial. But the other thought I had is if you had a patient who was a medical oncologist or somebody who was very knowledgeable and very interested and they looked at these data, you know, I'm thinking about some of the, we've done some work, actually even outside of breast cancer, about how much benefit people need in order to justify a therapy, particularly one that's very well tolerated. Mm-hmm. But if you explain this to a very educated, interested patient, here's the situation, maybe you'll live just as long if you don't do this, it's going to be a hassle getting the SR1. But on the other hand, on average, it's going to delay progression for, you know, quite a number of months. What fraction of people, after they heard that, do you think would want to be treated?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the same fraction of, you know, who wants to see their scans before they discuss them with the doctor, right? How much information do you want? What's your, I want to know everything versus I don't want to be anxious about something that's maybe not actionable. You know, I think we're going to have a lot of these conversations with patients, and I think there are going to be some patients that do want it. And I think that's entirely reasonable. I think we just have to understand the data on the back end with what we know. But Absolutely. I think this is a conversation with patients and one that we're going to be having frequently, but it's very nuanced. And so it is going to take a sophisticated patient to really understand the plus and the minus of doing this or not doing it.
So actually, I think that's what's driving the general medical, the community-based oncologists to be more, you know, interested in this, because I think there are a lot of situations in oncology that maybe the NCCN doesn't say category one and all, but they know that there are people out there who, if they knew about it, would want to do it. And that's always a challenge. So one more thing I just have to show you, although kind of unrelated to anything, but it could be. So we sort of snuck in a little HER2 there, you know, because of the Patina trial. I was curious, of course, as you can imagine, all the investigators are already moved over to CDK and HER2 positive. But I was kind of surprised when we said, in general, what's your first-line therapy? And we said multiple symptomatic liver mets. And I was surprised not everybody said T-DXd pertuzumab. I mean, that was the most common answer, but a little bit more than half said T-DXd, and the rest want to stay where they are. I'm curious, do you find that surprising? What do you hear from your colleagues?
I do find that surprising.
What do you think?
Yeah, I do find that a little bit surprising, you know, so people are less likely to adopt moving a drug up into the earlier setting, more likely to adopt now testing for mutations, et cetera, in the absence of progression. You know, I think what you're seeing here, I mean, I think the trastuzumab deruxtecan DB09 data with pertuzumab was very impressive. I think there is going to be a hesitancy for somebody in the first line setting to get 3 years, 4 years, 5 years of trastuzumab deruxtecan. That's a lot to ask. That's a lot of cumulative toxicity from something that does have a cytotoxic payload. And so I think you're seeing that desire of the maintenance regimen with Cleopatra, where you get to drop out the chemo and give trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And I anticipate that we're going to get there at some point with trastuzumab deruxtecan, kind of an induction regimen, so to speak, and then more of a maintenance regimen.
Yeah, well, here it is. They're already there.
There you go.
They're already saying they're going to do it. So they've already made that decision. And also, as we were saying, they're also on board for CDK and a HER2 positive. It also leads into this issue of just endocrine therapy in general in a HER2 positive patient. You know, this came up with CDK and all, and HER2 like is out there on the other side of the block, so to speak, of a lot of things. Everybody wants to see data in HER2, even with Trop-2 ADCs. I was curious, like, why wouldn't they? I mean, maybe there's no need for it or indication for it, but would that work in HER2 positive? Any thoughts about endocrine therapy in the HER2 positive patient? Do you think SERDs, PROTACs, and other strategies are going to come into the HER2 positive, triple positive situation?
I mean, absolutely. I think the answer to that question was really in Patina. You know, I think the that maintenance of adding palbo to endocrine therapy once the taxane is dropped out in combination with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, the magnitude of benefit there was really impressive. Now, we don't have an approval yet for that because we don't have a publication yet for it. But, you know, many people trying to go ahead and adopt that. I honestly think that this was a blind spot. I think we've neglected the ER-positive HER2, just grouping everybody into HER2, and there's a different biology for some of those patients that are more endocrine driven, and we certainly could put a different backbone in there for sure.
This concludes our program. Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA granted approval to imlunestrant for patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, ESR1-mutated, advanced or metastatic breast cancer with disease progression after at least one line of endocrine therapy. The approval was granted on September 25, 2025, based on data from the EMBER-3 trial. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes, and during this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Hamilton, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for exploring the potential role of PROTAC ER degraders in the management of hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer.